We do. It's my understanding both of you are ready, and I will introduce the panel to you. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right is Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. Will you please call the case?
Your Honor, we call appeal number 02-24-312-CV, Nina Lamb versus Tarrant County, Texas. Mr. John Crouch will argue for appellant, and Mr. David Hudson will argue for appellant.
Thank you. Mr. Crouch?
Sorry. Starting off splendidly there, dropping all my stuff. Well, thank you for hearing our case. I know my client thanks you as well. My client was a former deputy with the Tarrant County Sheriff's Department, and she ran into some trouble when she started having an interracial relationship with her. They're now married. We're not addressing the full case here. This is an interlocutory appeal, and the principal thrust of our issue here is whether or not she preserved her claims and is entitled to take her claims to trial with respect to the denial of her being promoted to the sergeant position. So the way it works is they put together a pool, and they rank everyone in the pool.
Just preliminary question. The order only addressed the claims related to promotion and training, although both sides did address in their briefing the termination issue. So are we all on the same wavelength theory that the termination issue is not an issue that's involved in this interlocutory appeal?
The termination itself is not involved in the interlocutory appeal. The issue is that when she was terminated, she was part of a promotion pool, and so she was on track to be promoted to sergeant. So she was fired before that promotion pool was exhausted, and then when she came back, they had put together a new promotion pool to sergeant, and of course she wasn't there at the time to participate in that and take the written test and take the oral exam and be put in the new pool. So essentially the argument is she was deprived of the ability to be promoted to sergeant. Once she's fired allegedly for cause, that takes her out of the pool, and obviously had she not been fired for cause, the termination was eventually reversed, and she, along with some white officers, were given a level 2 warning for some issues they all did. But had that been done to begin with, she would have been in this pool eligible to be promoted to sergeant.
So it is involved in the appeal to the extent that it involves promotion.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. Just the promotion is the interlocutory appeal. So I think the issue becomes, the way the pool works is they do written exams, and she did quite well on the written exam. She was 5 out of about 11 candidates on the written exam, and then they sat down in front of 3 officers, 2 white, 1 Hispanic, all male, and then she was given sort of an oral ranking based on the scores that these 3 officers gave her. And she went from being number 5 in the pool down to being number 8, I believe, after the oral interviews. And so as time went on through the year, one after another, positions came open, and they go down the list, and they put, when there's an opening, they put the candidate next up on the list in the sergeant position. So what we believe the facts show is that they went down through the first 6 people on the list. 4 white men, 2 white women, and then they stopped. And so one person left, and then there was a Hispanic, I believe a Hispanic woman, who was just beneath my client on the list, who started raising a ruckus. Why don't you've got open positions? Why am I not being put in the position? And so had she been there, she would have been the one raising the ruckus and saying, well, I'm next on the list. You've got open positions. Why am I not getting that position? Now, the technical issue that we're looking at here, in particular with the Elga Hill case, is when does my client have to file the charge of discrimination? She's got 180 days from the event under state law. Is the event when she was given a low ranking back in September 2020? Or is the event when she doesn't get promoted as people come up on the list? And so we think the answer has to be, or at least as the law existed back in 2020, the law can't be she had to file a charge when she got the low ranking. And Elga Hill basically says you've got to have this ultimate employment decision, which we thought that was the law back then, right? Now, the law has changed a bit since. There's the Muldrow case. That's a U.S. Supreme Court case. In fact, it's very similar on the facts. Muldrow versus the St. Louis, City of St. Louis, so the police department there, a woman police employee, and they shoved her over to the side because they wanted a man in that important position. And so he got all the perks. He got didn't have to work late very often. He got the drive your car home perks and that sort of thing. And meanwhile, she shoved off to the side, and her career is jeopardized. And the Supreme Court looked at that and he said, yeah, we know there's all these cases out there that talk about an ultimate employment decision, but we don't think that's supported by the statute. And so all you have to show is some negative effect on your employment from the discrimination. We also had, again, after 2020, but prior to the district court case, the Hamilton versus Dallas County case come out of the Fifth Circuit. That was a case where if you were a man and you were working in the jail, you could have weekends off. If you're a woman, not so much. We'll give you one day, but you can't have the entire weekend off. And so the women said, well, this isn't fair. And so they brought a claim saying that's facial discrimination based on gender. And the trial court said, yeah, but it's not an ultimate employment decision. None of you guys got fired. So what are you complaining about? So it goes up on the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit says, yeah, we know that's what our case law was, but there's clear discrimination going on here. There's nothing in the statute that really supports this ultimate employment decision. And therefore, as long as you can show there's some harm, we're not going to say exactly what the standard is. You get to file your charge. You get to bring your case. And so that's kind of where I think we are here. The county has essentially argued the discrimination happened when way back in September of 2020, when she got this low oral ranking, when she was trying to get herself promoted to sergeant. And they're saying, well, you should have filed the charge back then. That's when the harm happened. But under this Elga Hill case, as well as Fifth Circuit precedent that was at the time, and we thought was that's what the law was, negative evaluations don't do it. And in fact, in Elga Hill, this court actually sanctioned the employee who complained about poor evaluations and the supervisor harassing them because of their accent and so forth. So I don't think it's fair to say the charge should have been filed back in September 2020. So there are some other cases in our brief that talk about, well, what do you do in the situation where you're looking at the failure to promote, but it's a situation where there's an open position, but multiple people are being filled in the position. In other words, there's three positions in one of the cases, or in a situation like this, the positions come open. At what point is the harm that you need in order to be able to go and file your charge and eventually bring your lawsuit? So we think that point could not have happened until early 2021, so that she's within the 180 days. Had she remained number five on the list, number five came up, we believe, in the January, February 2021 timeframe. That's within the 180-day window, even if she should have been further down on the list, By the time she's fired, she's taken out of the list entirely, and she files promptly after she's fired. So we think she's timely on those claims, and we think the trial court erred. Trial court did, in a sense, follow the Elgahill case to a point, right? But we think probably this court should overturn Elgahill. The new law is you don't need the ultimate employment decision, but also we want reinstated her ability to bring those failure to promote claims.
So the law has changed a bit, you're arguing.
Yes.
Is it really the Intermediate Court of Appeals authority to declare new law, or shouldn't that be the Texas Supreme Court that makes that decision as to what the status of the policy is now, the status of the law? Aren't you asking us to go out on the limb and create a new precedent?
I think the federal case law on which this court relied in Elgahill has changed. I think it's appropriate for this court to recognize that and say there is a statutory authority for the proposition that courts should try as best they can to reconcile state and federal law. The federal law having changed in terms of when the person can go do the charge, I think it's appropriate for this court to say its existing authority should no longer be followed.
But isn't this more than just a negative review, assuming your client's understanding and beliefs were true, which was that she had been discriminated against because of gender and race, in her ranking after her oral interview, that is more than just a negative review, that is actually an adverse action?
It is a supervisor evaluation that puts her where she is relative to everyone else on the list. So the Elgahill case basically comes right out and says, well, a poor evaluation is not good enough.
My question is, isn't this more than just a poor evaluation? They actually took an action and ranked her because of what she considered was improper conduct.
I don't think so. I don't think so, because the issue with her now husband did not come up until later, so that did not factor in the evaluation for promotions.
As I recall from the transcript, your client testified that she believed that she was discriminated against in the ranking because of gender and race.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. So that's something that she knew at the time and believed at the time, right?
Yes.
Which would have been way back in 2020.
Yes.
Okay.
The problem is that she could not point to a decision that impacted her monetarily, right? So a failure to promote, that would satisfy, under the old rules, that's an adverse employment decision that satisfies the rule. You can go down to the EEOC, file your charge, wait your 180 days, file your lawsuit. But a poor supervisor evaluation under Elgahill, you cannot. So the problem is, back in September 2020, there hadn't been an adverse employment decision that hit her in the pocketbook yet. And that was the test back then, that you had to have some sort of monetary loss before you could go file the charge and bring the lawsuit. So the way the Fifth Circuit has dealt with it before Hamilton was, it said, when there's more than one position open, we understand you may not get the first position that's filled, you may not get the second, but it's not until the last position is filled that you have the adverse employment decision, and that's when the clock starts running. So we think, under the law as it existed back in 2020 and early 2021, the appropriate time isn't when you think you got a bad evaluation and it's going to impact you. The event is when they pass you over and put someone in the spot you think you would have had, and instead of you. That's when the event happens. I do briefly want to address one of the other issues that we've got here.
Are there any cases that address the question that we're looking at here saying, well, back when the events occurred, Ellicott Hill would have been the law. It's changed since then. So therefore, we were going to say, well, we're going to apply what was in effect at the time, even though that's changed. In other words, the retroactive application, so to speak.
None that I cited in my brief. I can do a post-oral argument submission on that if you would like.
I would be interested in that if you,
okay,
if the court grants you that.
I did briefly want to touch on the issue. I was concerned that the trial court basically sustained every evidentiary objection against my client and started striking her affidavit. The issue is one where you have statements from an employee of the organization. Those statements are normally exempt from the hearsay rule. And so we brought that with respect to five paragraphs that were improperly stricken.
But isn't it your burden to establish the predicate? It's not just that there are statements by an employee. There aren't, you agree that there are a series of requirements that go to, it's not just any employee you can talk about it, right?
It has to be statements from a then current employee within the scope of the employment relationship. So the principal statements that she was getting from a coworker who was on the same promotion list would, we believe, would have been within the scope of the employment of that officer.
Thank you. Mr. Hudson?
May it please the court. This case is important to the jurisprudence of the state because it presents an opportunity to clarify a complainant's obligation to make administrative complaint under Labor Code 21202 in a timely manner when she believes she's been discriminated against in a promotional process, in a kind of process that's very common in law enforcement, even if it may be more unusual for society in general. Before I get into that, I want to begin where Justice Wallach began with the role of the termination versus the other claims. There's no question, and it's agreed between the parties, that Deputy Lamb was terminated on May 20th, 2021, and she made administrative complaint about that a couple of months later. And so that's a timely claim, and there's jurisdiction for that. And that's not before this court. In his argument, and occasionally in his brief, it seems that Deputy Lamb's counsel and Deputy Lamb are looking at the promotion as a form of damages or as something that flows from the termination. And I address that in my brief on page 17 in footnote 3. And there is nothing that would prevent Lamb from arguing that her failure to receive promotions was part of her damages from the allegedly discriminatory termination. We don't disagree with that. The plea to the jurisdiction is about independent claims of failure to promote, especially about the process that occurred 10 months before she filed her complaint, and independent claims of training interference or failure to provide training opportunities. So 21202 says that any complainant must report unlawful discrimination within 180 days. And what's before the court here is only discrimination. There is retaliation charged as a in connection with the termination, but that's not before this court. It's purely discrimination that's before this court. And so the scenario is once a year, the sheriff's office would have a competitive promotion process that has two parts, a written test and an oral interview. They're scored at 50% each, and they produce a priority list. The priority list is good for a year to fill the sergeant positions that are going to come up in the operations division. Now, they don't know how many positions will come open, and they don't know what the timing will be, and neither do the employees. So if they generate a list of 11 people, they might never promote anyone off of it. They might promote three, they might promote 11. It's all uncertain, and it's uncertain to both sides. In September of 2020, they held a process, and they did rank the candidates 1 through 11, and the plaintiff ranked 9th out of 11 candidates at the end of the process. And the evidence that was admitted by the trial court at the plea to the jurisdiction is that the first six people were promoted off the list in order beginning September 19th of 2020, and the last one was promoted March 6, 2021. And that comes from the testimony of the sheriff's personnel manager who is testifying from the business records of the agency. There were no more operations sergeant positions available before plaintiff filed her complaint of promotional discrimination on July 15th, 2024. Her burden when she files her pleadings is to demonstrate on the face of the pleading allegations that show that she her claims meet the jurisdictional requirement, which would include showing that she satisfied 21-202. So the promotional discrimination that she alleges should have received some kind of a date on the face of those pleadings, and she didn't date it, which is part of what causes the confusion here.
Let's assume that that is a failure to plead yourself into jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That is, do you agree that that's not a case where you pleaded yourself out of jurisdiction?
Yes.
So in other words, if that were the case, then the proper remedy would be to give an opportunity to amend.
Yes. But this case had evidence presented and admitted from both sides, including her deposition, which clarified what she meant about discrimination and when she knew about it.
Let me ask another question.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume that the pleading is deficient in that regard. Is that cured by proceeding on to evidence as well?
You know, it could be if the evidence showed that there was some act of promotional discrimination within 180 days, but the evidence doesn't show that. The evidence that, as she testified to, is that she believed her interview was discriminatory. She believed.
I was asking because in your brief you say the deficiency in the pleading is sufficient in and of itself to justify the trial court's action. But if going on to evidence challenging the actual facts occurs, doesn't that move us past the pleading deficiency issue?
The pleading deficiency would have been sufficient at an earlier point, but now that there's evidence right in front of the court,
that's my question.
All the evidence has to be considered.
Right.
And so the evidence was that she believed in September of 2020 that she'd been discriminated against in the interview, that she'd been discriminated against in the ranking, and she was asked specifically, do you think they did anything discriminatory with that list after September of 2020? And she said no, she didn't think they did. So how do you time under the evidence the promotional claim that she's making independent of the termination claim? I submit the key is to look at the statutory wording of 21051, which defines what discrimination by an employer is, and it tells us three relevant things. 21051 does. Number one, it tells us from its language that discrimination is based on something the employer does. It's tied to various verbs that are tied to the subject employer. The employer discharges. The employer fails to hire. So we have to look at a time when the employer does something. Also, number two, the second thing that 21051 tells us is it's extremely broad. I'm sure we all remember how we were taught in school not to use in the definition of a word the word itself because it gets us confused. Well, that's exactly what the legislature did in trying to describe what discrimination is. They gave some examples and then they said that discrimination includes discriminating in any other manner. What they were telling us there is that the definition is extremely broad as it could possibly be, and they couldn't even think of all the things that might count as discrimination. And in the second prong of the definition, it tells us that if race or sex or any other invidious category are a cause of anything that limits, segregates, or classifies an employee or applicant in a manner that would tend to deprive an individual of any employment opportunity or adversely affect in any other manner their status, that's an unlawful practice. That sounds exactly like a competitive process with a ranking list, because that list classifies and segregates the employees And depending on whether they're higher or lower on the list, it tends to limit or expand their promotional opportunities. And I submit to the court that Lamb's concept of promotional discrimination is too narrow and strained given that language in 21051. What if an applicant is entitled to be selected, but someone else is chosen on a discriminatory basis? That would be another form of promotional discrimination. The problem with Deputy Lamb is there's no evidence before the court that that's occurred in this case. What if an applicant was entitled to be selected, but the employer fails to fill a position through some sort of a discriminatory ruse, such as ginning up a reduction in force? That would be another kind of promotional discrimination. They're all discrimination under 21051, but you date them according to their kinds, which is you date them according to the employer action. In this case, the only action that the employer took that she is complaining about under the evidence from her deposition is what took place in September of 2020, and she didn't complain about that for 10 months. Now, as far as the Elgigill case, the county cited the Elgigill case not in connection with the promotional argument, but in connection with the failure to train cases. And I cited it because it appears to be binding authority, but it also appears to be binding authority that's extremely questionable in light of the development from the Fifth Circuit and the United States Supreme Court. So all that was pointed out right away for the court to give it whatever weight that it thought proper. But simply speaking, on the training claims, they're all considered to be discrete actions by their very nature, and they're all back in 2020, not within 180 days either, except for the claim of February 2021. And the evidence in February 2021 that comes from the affidavit of Deputy Lamb is that they registered her for the course that she requested in that month. She told them that she couldn't attend because she had scheduled some other training for that time and said there had been a miscommunication. And so that simply didn't happen. There wasn't training interference according to the evidence in 2021. Elgigill was going through a list of things that are and are not cognizable unlawful employment actions in a retaliation. And they clearly said that decisions having to do with compensation and promotional decisions were in, and that bad evaluations were not. And to characterize the ranking in the promotional context as being a bad evaluation, I think, as Justice Wallach said, is really to overly minimize it and mischaracterize it. And I think that's a strained reading of Elgigill. So Deputy Lamb tries to suggest two different times for how this might be dated, rather than back in September of 2020 when the employer took the action and when she knew about the action. He suggests that, well, because on the first half of the process she scored number five, that when they promoted someone else to the fifth position, that's the time when you should use for dating the 180 days running. You can't simply make the assumption that because she liked the score of the first half and didn't like the score of the second half, that that's what the score would be without any discrimination. There's no basis to make that assumption. Then he also uses some case law where there are several positions that are open at one time and someone applies, and the failure to promote isn't, the 180 days doesn't start to run until the last position is filled. Well, this isn't a situation where there's a definite amount of positions. It's contingent on events, and neither side knows how many positions. There's really a contingency for the entire year. one of the purposes of 21-202, and it's found in old cases like the Schroeder versus Ironworks case, is early notice so that the employer can early investigate within 180 days the claims, and early conciliation. If there's a problem or a perception of a problem, and there's always at least a perception of a problem when somebody claims discrimination, you can have the opportunity for early conciliation. If you had to wait until all the possible positions that could come open were filled, you'd wait for the entire year. And then you'd have a mess because you'd run smack dab into the next promotional process and you'd have a clash between those. That is just not a practical rule. And not only is it inconsistent with the plain language of 210512 that clearly says that what happened back in September of 20 would be an actionable discrimination claim, or what she believes happened, but it's also inconsistent with a whole host of cases that say that the timing of a discrimination claim runs from the time that the employer takes action, not from the time that those consequences are felt later. And there's a whole bunch of cases that say that. The Chatta case and the specialty retailers case from the Texas Supreme Court, Comptroller versus Lansfeld from this court, Alexander from the Austin court. So, in sum, her discrimination claim on with respect to promotion really ties to those events in September of 2020. That's the only way to really date it under this record. She didn't complain for 10 months, and so we ask the court to affirm the decision of the trial court.
Thank you. Mr. Crouch?
Let me just, if I may, read some language from the Elga Hill case. Ultimate employment decisions that are actionable includes decisions to hire, discharge, promote, compensate, or grant leave, but not events such as disciplinary filings, supervisor reprimands, or even poor performance reviews. Likewise, hostility from fellow employees, verbal threats to fire, reprimands, criticisms of an employee's work, and negative employment evaluations do not constitute actionable adverse employment decisions. So, and again, I would just point out in Elga Hill, the court didn't just say, plaintiff, you're wrong on this. The court actually sanctioned the plaintiff $10,000 for having brought the lawsuit based
on
that charge.
Was that the only thing they were sanctioned for?
I think that was part of the mix. Obviously, it's a long opinion. There are a number of issues. But, you know, if I'm representing a client and I'm looking at the decision and I see sanctions, I'm like, oh. But there's another problem as well, and that is if all we have is the evaluation, we have this problem that we don't know how many positions are going to become available. And so is the actionable event the ranking? Or is the actionable event the failure to promote? And where in that process is the failure to promote? And again, I would point out a couple of cases where the Fifth Circuit wrestled with this very issue. In the Ortega v. Shurtoff case, cited in our brief, 600 F. Sep. 2nd, 828, the district court held limitations runs from the point where the last position was actually filled, and then it cites Vady v. Mississippi State University, that's 218 F. 3rd 365, and that was a situation where there were three positions that were open, and the court said the clock starts when the last of the positions is filled. So we think that the better
those cases involve situations like this where you don't know how many positions would be coming open over the next year, or is it there were three positions that were open at the time?
I think there were identified three positions open in that case, and then they spent months filling them. So Again, in this situation, it's a little different. We don't know if there will be any positions opened. In this case, there were at least six, and possibly, I think there's a disputed fact question as to whether there were more than that. Based on the plaintiff's testimony, it looked like there were a couple of open positions that were left open so they could then take the top white candidates from the new list in September 2021. So there's a dispute of that. But that's what it looked like from my client's perspective. We've also got the training issue that was briefly raised. Training under the old law, probably not going to be an adverse employment decision. Post Muldrow and Hamilton, training probably can be something. One of the things my client said when she was having the interview is, what can I do to make myself better? What can I do to get higher on the list? And the one thing they said was training. And so she had issue after issue getting the training that she needed. She was the only officer in her precinct who couldn't carry a rifle because they'd never got around to training her to in rifle mastery, basically, despite repeated requests to be able to do it. She was trying to get her, I think it was the advanced police, advanced officer's degree, tried repeatedly to get that done, tried to get that calendared, and then when they finally said you can go do it, she had already calendared another training because they had previously told her you can't do it on that date. So certainly post Muldrow, that would be actionable at the time it happened. Prior to Muldrow, we think we're looking at a situation where we have to show it relates to an actionable item, such as she didn't get promoted.
Was she precluded from doing that training because she had signed up for another training, or was it her choice that she had already signed up for another training when it was offered?
She asked. She was told the position is already filled, and then because that spot was filled, then she goes and signs up for something else so that she can be making use of her time.
But when they came back and says, in fact, there is space for you here, she could have gone to that. That was her choice, wasn't it?
I'm not certain that she could have. I'm not sure what the rules are in terms of if you pull out of the other one and then try and get into, I'm not sure if that was something that was feasible.
The record's unclear on that.
The record is unclear on that.
Thank you. Anything else?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, we appreciate your arguments here today. They were helpful to the court. Your case has now been submitted, and you are now free to leave.
Thank you so much. All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.